And so this is kind of like let's think of this as interactive because it's not really a talk, exactly. And so if you have any questions or anything, just throw a hand up. But I'm off. I often talk about the importance of contact with highly realized beings because there's transmission that happens. You get a sense of what their state of mind is or their realization, and we can help see. Resonate and see where we can go. And this is it's kind of a magic, and it really helps with a sense of direction. And it's much more emphasized in Mahayana and Zen tradition and Tibetan tradition, not so much in Theravada, but it's still there, but it doesn't mean it doesn't work. It's just a little different. So, skipping part of that part. So I've never done this before, and I actually had to do some research on my life to remember what I've done. So it turns out I've been to Asia 10 times, starting from 1978, and the last was in 2024. So that was 5 trips to India, 4 to Thailand, twice to Nepal, once each to China, Myanmar, Japan, Korea, and Sri Lanka. And every one of those visits was at least some component of pilgrimage or retreat. And most of them, that's exactly what they were. So I pretty much, I haven't traveled. In India, I mean, I traveled. I never did it. I've just gone places to do retreat, and I was joking. I've only gone swimming once in all of that in Thailand one time. I've never been to a bar. Never went trekking. It's just been pretty focused. But the good news is that actually bears fruit because we set priorities. It's been pretty. When I was going through this and I looked, I literally pulled out the names of people I contacted and came up. With a list of 17 people who I'm not going to talk about all of them, but kind of really just blew me away, basically. Really hit me in the heart, like, oh my God, kind of people. And some of them I've had teachings from, and some of them I haven't. Geshe Dargye showed up once at a thing. I was like, oh my God. You could just feel radiating off him. So I didn't even include him in the 17, come to think of it. And I have had great good fortune to have been in multi-day teachings with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And several other, five of those, yeah, five of those from 89 to 2017. So that's pretty amazing. And so, I was trying to figure out how to share this in a way to be helpful. Because what do you do with 17 people? It's not exactly useful. So I kind of came up with, I think it was five different sort of categories of what I sensed, what moved me from these different contacts. And I'll just say a little bit about, individuals. Kind of like one individual per or two per of the five, and see if this works. Just a way to kind of get our hearts around it. Does that make sense? And again, if you have any, just throw up your hand. So great radiance of mind was one of those. Great radiance of mind was just, and actually two. So I'm thinking of two, and these are sort of interesting. I mean, like the Dalai Lama could be in every single one, And one of these is not Buddhist, Muktananda, because I was in Gurudev Siddhapith, which is an ashram in India in 1978 for 4 months. And he's incredible. He had his flaws, to be sure. And he's also just incredible. And they do this thing in that tradition, Hindu tradition, called darshan, where there was a courtyard, and he would just sit in the courtyard and do absolutely nothing for hours. He might lift his finger once in a while, and it was just transfixing. It's just like, oh my God, wow. It was just so amazing. It was just his presence, his awareness. It was really amazing. It's almost just because it was so simple that it was amazing. And I was lucky because we had seva work to do in the ashram. So mine was at 3 in the morning at a security. So that meant in the middle of the afternoon, when other people were doing seva cleaning and stuff, I wasn't. So there was a relatively small group of us sitting in the courtyard. So that was amazing. And the other time, I've told this story before, so forgive me, but so how do I construct this? So Gurudev Siddhapith is in Maharashtra, and there used to be way back when before, now it's this great big thing with buildings and all this stuff, but when he first started, it was just him in a hut. And the hut's still there. And he used to practice in the hut. And then they built a building around the hut. And then they built a thing called a cave under the hut so you could meditate in the cave under the hut because it was kind of like, had importance. So the courtyard around the hut, which had these big curtains. So it was kind of semi-dark, even in the middle of an incredibly bright day. And he would walk around in there because no one would bug him. because people would tend to follow him around if he, you know, because he's a guru, if he walked around the ground. So he would walk. So I was down in the cave meditating for a few hours this one day, and I came out, and I'm just sort of like, you know, a little bit blinded by the light, and I'm walking out and turns, and I came around a corner and just went face to face with him. Like, you know, I mean, I basically almost ran into him. And it was just, you know, 5 seconds where we just stopped, and I'm like, come on, I was just wide open because I've been practicing. And there was nobody there. It's hard to describe. It was just this incredible awesomeness. Just like, I remember going, oh my God, you know, it was, and then he kind of like twinkled at me and did a little sidestep and kept going, you know. But it stuck with me ever since. And so just sharing that. In 1995, my wife and I, on our honeymoon, went to India and Nepal, and we ended up in Kathmandu when Choki Nyingma, who's incredible, was giving teachings, and he's one of the sons of Tukul Urgyen, so he's in the Nyingma tradition. So they were amazing, but the thing that blew my mind was towards the end, they brought in this aging Sakya Lama from the Sakya tradition, who was, you know, I don't know, in his late 80s or something, very kind of helped him in. And he had so much presence. Ellen and I still talk about it. We were like, I don't know, it's hard to describe. He didn't say a word. He just was. But he brought it. They said, this is an incredible opportunity. We're going to just, he's going to sit here for a few minutes. And it was just incredibly awesome. It's hard to describe. But it's one of those things that I've just had in my heart ever since, you know. It's like when things are dry, you know, it's like, oh yeah, that is, in fact, when it's all peeled away, that's who we are. So, and it was like zero words. In both of these cases, zero words, you know? It was just radiance of mind. So, the second one, any, no, I'll just, this is, I'm not going to be real long, but again, raise a hand if you wish. The second one was the power of a lineage bringing into this time. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama is incredible that way. I mean, he's the 14th Dalai Lama. So, in terms of how we understand him, he's not just this guy now. He's the 14th Dalai Lama. He's been going through multiple rebirths, and this is the 14th. And so it's hard to describe, but there's a way in which when you really take that in and realize how far back that goes, we sort of end up sort of holding, understanding this person differently because he is part of this incredible lineage. And watch how he is. I mean, if any of you had the chance to watch him teach, when he teaches, it's just, it's like, it's hard to, he's like, his teachings are brilliant and are incredibly beautifully structured, and they're funny and they're warm, and it's an incredible flow of logic, and he ends right exactly where he was supposed to end with the whole arc of what he was going to teach ending right there. It's like, oh my God, how do you do that? You know, it's just amazing. So it's a sense in which it's not just about this lifetime. You know, he's trained his whole life, but it's this whole incredible sense of lineage. I did have the opportunity when I was in China to go to, in Yunnan province. I've never been to Tibet per se, but Tibet used to be much bigger. And, you know, the Tibetan Autonomous Region is a thing in China, and Tibet used to be much bigger than that. So in Yunnan province, there was, that was Tibet. And there's a monastery built by the fifth Dalai Lama, which somehow missed getting torn down completely during the Cultural Revolution. And maybe because it's not in Tibet, I was amazed when I was there. I spent a whole day practicing there, and there weren't any police, there weren't any monitors, there wasn't any anything. There was just monks, and it was great. But just the thought that the 14th Dalai Lama, he built that. I mean, not with his hands, but he had it built. You know, it's really something. So I share that because, and that's where, you know, all these people are from Asia, basically. I mean, I have a lot of respect for highly realized Western teachers, you know, Joseph Goldstein or those kind of folks. They're amazing. And there's a sense in which the great beings in Asia, you know, they're just the lineage, you can taste it. You know, you can taste it, and it's really profound. So, Dalai Lama, at least for me, you know, I mean, Zen people have a whole different sense of lineage, but at least for me, that's just so amazing. Okay. So the third one. Any questions about any of that? This is going to go by pretty quick.
What do you mean the Zen people have a whole different
Well, they have a very strong sense of lineage. From their point of view, it goes all the way back to the time of the Buddha. And so they have a very strong sense of lineage. And it's a real interesting phenomena going on, in this, because of Northwest Dharma news, I've sort of tuned into it in the greater Northwest and Western Canada, because when there's a Zen teacher of a particular group, there's a bunch of groups in Seattle, and if that person dies, retires, gets sick or something, they need to have someone with transmission to be in that position. It's not just anybody that they vote in. So it actually creates some interesting dynamics trying to find and tune into and bring in that kind of person. So there's been lots of interesting things going on around that question. But yeah, so from their point of view, it goes all the way back through lineages of mind transmission from one teacher to another. And Tibetan tradition, there's, I can't think of the name, but there's a, like Dzogchen teachings or something, there's a book transmission and a mind transmission, and they're parallel but different, is one aspect, and the other aspect is the whole Tukul thing and the recognized reincarnations. The 17th Karmapa in the Kagyu tradition, he's around right now, and the 16th died in the 20th century. So there's lots of multi-rebirth persons in Tibetan tradition in a way this is hard for us. We funny, gringo mongrels, whatever we are, to understand that, but it's powerful. And it helps. I think, to kind of, these are things that I find that I just tune into, during a dry period, because, fine, I'm having a dry period. But I kind of utilize or tune into, I am too, is what I'm saying. We're sharing. Dry period sharing. to tune into this can really be helpful, because it's so hard to keep, you were kind of referring, it's hard to keep your compass, right? In the myriad, and also a brain, in the myriad complexity of everything. But to be able to just kind of find a place where we click into that sense of direction. Yeah.
So in the sense of.
Maybe you could do the mic so that out of courtesy for everybody else. Yes, sir.
So thinking about these illuminated beings that reincarnate and bring teachings from distance,
Yeah.
this present moment.
Right.
When you're in front of them, it is like I have like this myriad questions, because they're born and they need to learn again to talk, to recognize things, to live in this realm. Yet there's something, and I don't know. And like my question is, how to describe like the spirit muscle to get back to focus, to get back to
Right.
the path of being enlightened and teaching others.
Right.
But it is without words. It's, they need to learn the words to tell it, but they already know what to. So.
It's complicated. Yeah, I mean, I can say two things come to mind. Because it's not, I mean, I don't, what do I know? I don't know about recognition of rebirths. And there have been some, Western persons who have been recognized as rebirths, and some of that's gone really well, and some of them not so much. Their path had to be different. I don't know. They didn't become a teacher, they became a lawyer or something. So who knows? I did have one experience one time, come to think of it, when in 1991 I was in retreat in McLeod Ganj, so in India, up above. I think I told you something, but it was so amazing. So the junior tutor of the Dalai Lama died X number of years ago, but then rebirth was there, 4 years old, and he was in training and he was in full robes and the whole deal. Did I ever tell anybody this? Did anybody just ring a bell? Okay. So it was, and so it was going to be his fifth birthday. He was four. It was going to be his fifth birthday. He's a kid, he's 4 years old. And a couple of us got together and got him a chocolate cake. He'd never seen a chocolate cake before, and there was this little audience. There was a little audience, a bunch of Westerners in McLeod Ganj. So they had somehow it got arranged that there was this little audience right over on his birthday, I think, with, maybe 15 of us Westerners from all over the world, a lot of Europeans and all this stuff, sitting, and he's up on his throne. He's on a throne dressed in full monk garb, has this kind of guy next to him, another lama. But he had toys and things on his throne, little trucks and things. But he was also a lama. It was very interesting. And so there was a little period when we could ask him questions. So people are saying, do you remember your former lifetime? And he wasn't sure if he did, and a couple things like that. And then there's one Dutch woman, she said, well, do you want to ask us any questions? I mean, and he said, actually, he did. And suddenly he says, how seriously do people practice the Dharma in your countries? This is not just a plaything. This is about changing your mind. And everyone went, oh, 4 years old. You know, it was like, oh my God. So that kind of, I mean, that really blew me away because there was this power coming through. So, you know, I don't know, but I'll offer that as an aspect of this complicated subject. Yeah. And at the same time, you know, I mean, when people say they're, even in this group, if someone says, I'm new to the practice, I often say, I don't believe you, or that doesn't mean, or I don't know, you might have been my teacher before, I don't know, you know, or someone like the Ajahn Nisobo or Kovalev, my God, where's that guy, 35 years old, where's that coming from, you know? So there's a lot of amazing people coming through and popping up these days. It was that woman in our class, what was her name, in the intro class, I can't think of her name. Anyway. But just she showed up late, and she had this book. I said, what are you reading? And she said, oh, I'm reading this book by Dzogchen Rinpoche. And I was like, what? She said, I'm new to the practice, and I'm reading a book by Dzogchen Rinpoche. And I was like, okay, those two things don't go together. And so we ended up having a conversation, and she had some incredible depth. I mean, she had no idea how deep she was in a way, because I just felt, I said, you got momentum, my friend, you know, so... Yeah, I think so. She was just going to town. Yeah. Yeah, she's something else. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right. It's good. We're ahead of ourselves, right? Yeah. I mean, I'm not, but she is. Yeah. But it's helpful. You know, I really think it's helpful to recognize that and just kind of hold in our hearts that possibility. You know, wherever you're at on rebirth, but if rebirth is true, then it makes sense that... There we go. That some people might have momentum. Yeah, Monica.
So my question is maybe adjacent to the previous one. I noticed how you described your interactions with these people, and I noticed that you had this really visceral reaction, you know, not based on conversations, but... just on something other than, you know, like wisdom that comes from their mouth. And I'm coming to realize that for myself, I don't, at the same time, I don't trust anybody until they tell me words. But at the same time, words are not enough. I have to feel something other than words, because, you know, I'm thinking of like one Western Buddhist teacher. Will not mention the name, but he's very, very smart and he's very brainy and he has like very, very good ideas, but I just don't connect with him emotionally.
Yeah.
But I mean, I can't put my finger because, you know, I was brought up in such a hyper intellectualized environment. I can't put my finger on this visceral piece that you seem to naturally get. And yeah. I don't know whether you can put that into words. I know it's kind of like absurd to ask you, but like, how do you connect? Like, how did you decide that these people are, you know, someone to look up to, respect?
Yeah. I'm not sure look up to, but yeah. Recognize. I don't know. I don't know if visceral is the word I'd use, but it's a sense of transmission is the word that kind of works for me, you know, but... and you know, I sort of second guess is not the right word, but I'm careful about these things because, you know, we can make mistakes, or people can be a mixture of aspects too. There's that, you know, they can have a strong reading there and also mess up their ethics. That has happened, sadly, a lot. So
well, that's what worries me about the whole guru tradition and revering people, especially in some Eastern traditions. Right. That there's just potential for absolute misconduct is the mild way to put it.
It is a tricky thing. I'll say one thing about that, and I'm and then I got two people with hands up. So, but I do guru yoga and Nyingma tradition, and the ultimate guru is our own nature of mind. There may be a guru in person, but the ultimate guru is our own nature of mind, so it takes that away. And that is one good thing about Theravada tradition, part of why that's where I practice mostly, is there aren't gurus. You know, that's not the relationship of a Theravada teacher to a student. The Dharma is the transmission, not a person. So for me personally, because of a similar skittishness that I hear from you, I have over the years kind of gone in that way. But having said that, I also have huge respect for Tibetan persons. It's just my own temperament right now. Ultimately, we have to look into our heart energy, or, you know, mind heart, and see that way. Yeah. Okay. Marianne.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I felt that energy around Thich Nhat Hanh. I was about 20 years into Zen practice, and I was in a practice period at Gringotts Farm, which is a very small place run by the San Francisco Zen Center. And he was in town, and he came for a weekend, I think it was. But it just... He embodied the Dharma in such a way that every movement he made and anything he said, which was said very simply, just his whole character, his being came through. Egolessness. Right. And it changed my life because I had struggled with the practice I'd been trying to learn, and it was like I absorbed him. He became me. Yeah. And I just settled into it. You know, there was no words about it. You just knew.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. And probably when you're reading the book you were describing, because you've had that experience, you're reading in a whole different way than most of us would.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get his intellectual side until I started reading something like this book.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Marianne. Just watching the time a little bit too. Bonnie.
Two questions. I've heard that word transmission, but what is being transmitted? Is it a feeling? I'm curious what is being transmitted. Because, yes, I have been around people that are very holy, and there is a countenance about them that is attractive. But what is being transmitted? And the second question, and I know we're short on time, anybody that you've come in contact with, would you consider an arahant?
So transmission is just, you know, it's like, I don't know, Buddha nature. It's the awakened nature of mind, that essence of mind that's empty and aware. And we can contact someone who's recognized that in themselves in a way that we haven't. And it helps us see that in ourselves. I don't know about the arhant thing. I mean, and I'm going to talk about it towards the end. You know, I think maybe some of the gentlemen that I had when I went to Thailand this fall, that was partly, I don't know if it was a mission, but that was the idea. And, you know, maybe so. And that's Ajahn Liam, maybe so. I don't know. I honestly couldn't tell you. But it's really worth opening our hearts. And, you know, it's a matter of degree. It's a matter of degree of energy of awakened mind that comes across on all kinds of levels. And, you know, that's part of why the two Ajahns are so cool. Because they got a lot of that in them. Are they arhants? I don't know. Probably they're pretty young. Probably not. I don't know. I don't know. I don't have to worry about it, sort of. But it's kind of like, sort of in an ultimate sense, it is contact on an energy level with the awakened nature of mind that's inherent in us. And most of us don't see it yet because of obscurations. But it's the same. So it helps us move towards something. Otherwise, we tend to get lost and buffeted. Does that make some kind of sense? Would you want You got one more follow clarification? All right, we'll go ahead. All right. So, three other categories, I think. So, this is just stuff I made up, to be sure. Speaking with certitude of realization. And I got two of these. One was Buddhadasa, who, as some of you know, I met him in 1989 in Thailand, and he's one of the two great Buddhadasa and Achan Cha, or sometimes the sort of most sort of broadly known great Thai masters. If you go to Ottathama, they're very tuned into Buddhadasa, and there's all kinds of Buddhadasa books and statues and photos and stuff here in Woodinville. So Swan Mok in South Thailand, and it's kind of like in the western side on the Gulf of Thailand. Swan Mok is down there. That's his monastery. And I went there just flying blind. I mean, I knew I had a book. I got the Great Living Buddhist Masters, which, of course, has been renamed because none of them are living anymore. But I went to see Achan Cha and then took a bus to Swan Mok and just arrived. And they said, oh, yeah, all the monks are gone. They're starting to have a 10-day in Koh Samui, which is an island. And so darn, you know, it's too bad. And he says, oh, yeah, but Buddhadasa's right over there. You can go talk to him. I went, what? They said, no, you can go ask him a question. I was like, okay. So I went over there, and I don't know if you've seen pictures of him, but he was like literally sitting on a kitchen chair, much funkier than any of these chairs, in the dust with chickens running around and some stacks of magazines. This is not a fancy situation. And I was just coming out of, that's when I was moving into Buddha Dharma and coming out of years of Hindu practice and the whole thing about Atman and Anatta and all that. I was trying to process all that. So I asked him, is it true that in Buddhism, there's no self? He spoke English and he looks at me and he says, yes, there's no self in Buddhism. And I just went, whoop. I went, okay. I just sort of accepted it. I sort of got it. I mean, I was saying I had a realization even. It was just, I could feel the profound understanding that he had. And it just, like, my mind just shifted and went, okay. That was it. That was the whole conversation. But it was amazing. It was just this certitude of recognition that he carried with him. I can't even describe exactly how it was. But it was so amazing. and really something. The other one is back when I was in a 3-month retreat in 91. I mentioned that earlier, I think. So I was in Tushita, which is up above McLeod Ganj, and I had this little hut for 3 months. It was pretty cool out in the forest. And Genla Rinpa, who I'll talk about later, was a mile away through the forest, so I could go see him on Wednesday afternoons. But towards the end of it, there's this, like, I mean, I was pretty much away from people. So I wasn't hardly ever talking to people, but people started saying, oh, Kirti Sensha Rinpoche is going to be coming here. I was like, who's that? And he was this Galupa Lama who'd been in retreat for 15 years up in a hut up above McLeod Ganj and had, you know, fled Tibet in 59 and used to be abbot of a big monastery. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So when he came to teach, it was so amazing. There was all these people showed up from up there, up in the hills, all these lamas and people who were in retreat. So all of a sudden there was like 30 Tibetans in incredibly dirty robes because they were up in caves and huts and things up there. I was like, wow, this is amazing, you know, because he was such a big deal. And I did the math and he wasn't that old. He was 65, but he was very frail. They kind of helped him out. They were supporting him and he's kind of teetering up to the throne. And I was saying, oh, okay. I can hardly walk because this is whatever, you know, I was being my weird American self. And then he started teaching and he just lit up. It's hard to describe, but something just went poof, and he was just incredibly vigorous and he just sparkled. I mean, he was just saying, it's kind of like Dalai Lama. You get a sense, he sees it and he's trying to explain what he sees. Find ways to explain what he sees to you. That's kind of what the whole suttas are about. The Buddha saw it, and he's trying to explain to people. So it's kind of like that. It was so big. And I was like, oh, my God. I was just blown away. And a funny thing was there was this guy from Harvard was there. There was a bunch of Westerners there, too, you know, kind of world traveler types and people there in the bookstore because Tushita is this retreat center that has three little retreat huts, but they have lots of 10-day courses and things. The retreat huts are happily hidden away. Anyway, this Harvard guy, who's, you know, a Harvard guy, so he's smart, he decided to challenge, for some reason, Kirti Simchab Rinpoche in a question. He asked this kind of aggressive, challenging kind of a question about emptiness or something. I have no idea what it was. And he thought, oh, you know, I could see he was all full of himself and I'm smart and who is this guy? And in a very loving way, Kirti Simchab, he just took him apart. He just took him apart. In not a bad way, but just in terms of the where the guy was coming from, and he just went ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And the guy went, oh. And it was really amazing to watch. So it was kind of like, so it's not personal. He took apart his logic. He brought realization to the moment. It was just funny to watch. And the guy was not mean to the guy or anything. He just dismembered his attachment to his logic. So it was beautiful. Anyway, and he kept teaching for many years. He died not so long ago. So I think, yeah, two more things. Watching the clock at me. I think we're good. The second was joyous flexibility. Joyous flexibility. And two people I thought of, because I looked at my list and was saying, you know, just scanning my sense of them. Lama Tarchin was a Nyingma yogi, and he was very close for Ellen and I. We studied with him a lot. He stayed at our house one night even. So he came and taught in Seattle, stayed at our house. So he was a Nagpa yogi. In Nyingma tradition, a Nagpa yogi, they're kind of almost like shamans. He had long hair down to his back, and he'd pile it up on top sometimes. He was not a monk. He was a Nyingma yogi. He had a couple of relationships in the time I knew him. Did it very elegantly, but with beautiful women, you know. But he was this. He had this amazing radiance, and he was just smiled. He smiled a ton. He was just incredibly loving, and my wife just hit a chord for her. So she really loves him still. He's no longer with us, but he was so positive. Sometimes it was his organization a little bit dysfunctional because he wasn't very good at saying no. So people kind of ran over each other a little bit, but he was astonishing. And just that sense of like incredible encouragement and loving and support. I had an interview with him one time, and he was so, so affirmative about everything I was doing while I was practicing. And it was just, I mean, I still remember it all happy, you know, because it was amazing. And then Ajahn Ganha, who I met just this last year in 2024 in Thailand, and rumored to be an Arhant, speaking of that, a student, if that's the right word, of Achan Cha. So he was in the real rigorous early years of Wat Pa Pong, when it was just grueling, he was there. Ajahn Ganha was amazing. I mean, me and Jason first arrived, I mean, literally like 3 minutes after we arrived, this pickup truck comes by. He's not driving. He's sitting and he's inspecting something that's being built. And he rolls down the window and he's beaming at us and he's giving us cookies and giving us little juicy boxes and just how are you and where are you from? And then 3 minutes later, he wants you to come up to his kuti. So all of a sudden, we'd just gotten off the boat and me and Jason are in his kuti with this German monk translating. And he was just so endearing and just asked us about ourselves, and he tried to cut my hair But and I watched him. The time I was there, he just pull people in, like constantly there'd be, you know, the way the thing is that there's a meal, has to be by noon, and there's a meal offering there pretty early, not early, but like 8 o'clock, 8 a.m. or something like that was a meal, and then a big cleanup thing. But he'd have a second meal offering up at his kuti. They'd bring extra food and a bunch of specialty, it was more like, people were there from all over the world, and you know, Westerners and Asian people from Singapore. It's a whole incredible assortment of people. But it'd be the second meal, and then he kind of look around and he'd engage with people, and he'd sort of say, oh, there's a lot of Chinese people here. Okay, all you Chinese people, come up here. And he'd take them all up to his kuti, and he'd do this thing for an hour. And he just was like extending himself constantly in this incredibly loving way. It was just amazing. And he'd pick people out, too. He'd like, you know, he got to know me, the two Americans, and he'd pick us out. And he'd kind of like make fun in a very loving kind of way, and so it was just delightful. It was just delightful. So it was kind of a sense of incredible encouragement, because he was also really fierce about the practice and pushing, you know. He was pushing people, but he did it in this really uplifting, happy kind of way. So that's joyous flexibility. And he was very flexible. He just somehow, I mean, watching him, he would just like, he was just rolling with the situation and rolling with wherever you were coming from. You know, there was like some woman who was having a hard time, and suddenly, boom, he was like really very compassionately talking to her, for drawing her out about this place where she was hurting in the middle of this group. But he did it in a way that wasn't violating boundaries. But, you know, and then someone else, he'd be like joking with him and making sort of fun of them in a teasing kind of, come on, you know, you silly person, why are you still hung up on your car? Really? You know, and just kind of tweaking along. So he was great. And then the last one, is that the last one? No, two. Are we okay? We're going to run a tiny bit over? Is that all right? Oh, you can leave. We're going to run a tiny bit over, but I'll do my best. Unequivocal dedication to the path. And two people just jump out. One, so Chagatukul Rinpoche and Jetson Palmo, who, by the way, is the only Westerner in this group. So Chagatukul Rinpoche, he was a great Nyingma Lama. There's still a very strong group, Amrita here. Lama Pema, who's a Westerner, is very one of the high lamas in that organization. Anyway, Chagatukul Rinpoche was amazing because he had this, he wasn't exactly forceful, but of any of these people, was anyone I would find a little scary, it was him. He had this ferocity to him, and the guy was unstoppable. I mean, he arrived from, you know, out of Tibet, and he had this idea that there's something could happen in the West. And I've heard these stories. Ridzing Ling, it's up in Northern California, it's a center. I've done a lot of retreat there. When they were looking around for a place, just like Clear Mountain's looking around for a place, and they found this place that was a former rock quarry. So it was a complete disaster. But it was this space, there were mountains in the back, and he says, yep, this is it. And everyone's going, oh, really? Oh, come on, not this. You know, and so they had to bust ass for years to turn that thing into what it is now, and it's just beautiful. But he just had this amazing, not forceful in a bad way, but he just, and his one of his key things was never give up. I think that's how he said, never give up. He said all the time, don't give up, don't give up, don't give up. No matter what obstacles came up, he would just constantly saying that. And then he's like, and he married this wonderful British woman. I got to know her a certain amount. In fact, one time I was having some kind of relationship problem. We talked about it, and he said, oh, you know, just because he's an awakened lama doesn't mean there's never any relationship problems. One time he said to her, in Tibetan sentence structure, verbs are at the end of the sentence. And he says to her, your face never again I want to see. Isn't that great? But nonetheless, he was awakened. It was at a certain level. And so when he was in his, I think in his 70s, he got in his head to go to Brazil and start all over again, which he did. And he built now this huge gompas in Brazil. He did this whole thing in Brazil. And then right at the end of his life, the day before he died, he said, I'm going to give Poa teachings. And Poa is Phowa in Tibetan tradition. It's called mind transference, transference of consciousness at the time of death. It's a whole conscious thing about consciously taking your consciousness out when you die. So he gave this Poa teaching all day, intense all day of teaching, died the next day. And then when he died, he was one of these deals where they worked out this deal with the Brazilian government where they just left him alone and his body just sat there for days and days and days in the middle of Brazil, untouched, not rotting, still sitting, you know, that whole incredible awakened being thing. So he was something else. He did three early retreats, and he went all through all the chaos in Tibet and left in 59. Never give up. And the other one is Jetson Palmo. Some of you may know, she's British. She has an amazing book. What's it called? She spent 12 years in a cave. What's it called? Yeah, yeah. Can't think. Maybe I'll think of it. Anyway, she's amazing. I mean, she spent 12 years in a cave, and she, you know, technically she almost died. I mean, she got totally snowed in. The people who were bringing her food were sort of forgot for a while. She was completely like, if you read the book, I can't think of it. It's amazing because there was a period when she was absolutely, completely snowed in for months, couldn't get out. It turned out you can still breathe when you're completely snowed in. She didn't have much food, but she just said, well, okay, if I die here, I'll die here. And she wasn't lonely because there was all these yidams with her, meditational deities. And she's just so tough. I had a chance to get teachings. She's still alive. In fact, she's done interviews with the monks, two of them, and she really likes them. It's very cute. They're cute as hell. They're really funny. She really likes the monks. So yeah, you can go on Clear Mountain website. Oh yeah, I had teachings. She gave teachings on the Great Wheel of Samsara at McLeod Ganj in 2017. I happened to be there, and that was great. So she's just fierce in a very funny, loving kind of way, but completely unstoppable. So, you know, that unequivocal dedication. She's just so dedicated. It's just, nothing's going to stop her. It's really inspiring. Cave in the Snows.
Cave in the snow. Yeah.
Cave in the Snows, you did it.
Cave in the Snow.
Yeah. And then the last one is Fierce and Unwavering Ethics. And I just been pulling out Genla Rinpa, he was incredible. He was my first teacher. He and Alan Wallace were my first teachers. So he's way in my heart. And he was a Galupa Lama and monk, and high on the Geshe track. So he was on the verge of becoming a Geshe, which means becoming like a PhD, like a doctorate degree. But it's sort of at the last moment he pulled back and just said, nope, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to dedicate my life to practice. And that's what he did. And so he came here twice to teach. And I was so, so fortunate. That three-month retreat I mentioned, he was my guide during that retreat. And his hut was a mile through the forest. So I go and see him on Wednesday afternoons. And this wonderful Australian monk would translate. But there was something about him. It was just like, how do I say? Ethical breaches are posited on something you want. And therefore, we lie about it. We steal it. We do sexual misconduct, whatever, because we want something, and it's often at the expense of someone else. He didn't want anything. He totally didn't want anything. It was just clean as a whistle. In fact, he wouldn't even take Donna. He didn't want there to be any kind of transactional money. He said, you know, if I'm going to come, you're all going to have to support me somehow. He wouldn't do Donna. There was no Donna basket. And just amazing. Just amazing.